Hello, everyone. My name is Brian Parno, and this is joint work with my colleagues Chris, John, Jay, and Brian at Microsoft Research, as well as our interns Don Fang and Arjun. So today, when you submit your personal information online, the strongest possible guarantee you can get is something that looks like this. Essentially, they promise they're going to use SSL, and they're going to try really hard to protect your data. And unfortunately, even if you believe that they really are trying just as hard as they can, all it takes is a single mistake anywhere in their software, and you have yet another headline-making data breach. In contrast, with Ironclad apps, we're going to guarantee to the remote user that every single assembly instruction executing on that remote machine adheres to a high-level specification for the app itself. That means that Alice can obtain a cryptographic key and a statement that convinces her, say, that her password will never leak, or that her data will never be misused by this service. So we're able to provide this very strong guarantee through a combination of three techniques. First, we use late launch, a feature supported by AMD and Intel chips, to run our software stack in a protected environment. We then use trusted computing to tie that software to a cryptographic key. Finally, we use software verification to prove that the software actually has some desirable property and to tie it back to a high-level specification. Together, these techniques give us a property that we call secure remote equivalence. What that means is essentially that Alice can create a secure channel, meaning that her messages remain secret and integrity protected, and she can use that channel to talk to essentially the abstract version of the application. She no longer cares about the implementation because she knows that it provably meets that specification. Now, in some sense, this is the ideal case for trusted computing. We're no longer attesting to some random piece of software. Instead, we're attesting to software that provably has desirable properties. But of course, it's that final part, proving that the software has desirable properties, that is quite hard. People have been working on this for 40 years or more, and it's only recently with projects like SEL4 that we've even seen that this was possible to do for systems-level software. Fortunately, in our work, we're able to advance this another step forward and say that we can verify an entire software stack, and we can do so with a reasonable amount of effort. So effort that's comparable to what you would do for a test-driven approach, and yet we can give you much stronger guarantees than you would have had otherwise. In particular, we can guarantee that there will be no buffer overflows, no problems with control hijacking, no problems in the implementation of your cryptographic primitives. But it's more than just a list of negatives. It's actually a strong positive property that says what the application is going to be doing with your sensitive data at any given time. Now, these guarantees come with a couple of caveats. First, we don't prove the absence of side channels. Our model isn't adequate to capture that. Second, we focus on security, integrity, and functionality. We don't model liveness, however. And finally, we don't prove that the physical hardware itself is secure. If that's something you're worried about, I would refer you to the Haven talk tomorrow morning. Now, to be a little bit more precise about our goals, we want to verify that the software has end-to-end security. That means it needs to be complete. We don't want to trust any of the software running on the system, and so that means we need to verify the OS, we need to verify the drivers, we need to verify the libraries, and the app itself. We also want it to be low level. So we don't want to trust the compiler. We don't want to trust the runtime. We want to verify the actual assembly instructions that are going to execute. And yet, despite this ambition, we also want to enable rapid development of verified software, because this seems to be one of the key barriers to seeing these techniques adopted in the wild. Now, we made an explicit decision not to verify existing code on the theory that if we can't verify an entire software stack when the code has been written for that purpose, we're certainly not going to be able to verify legacy code. And similarly, we decided to focus on security, and so performance was a secondary concern. Now, that said, it's important to note that unlike, say, type-safe languages, where you always have some inherent overhead, with verifiable code, there's no inherent reason why you should be any slower than unverified, unsafe code. It's just a matter of how much time you're willing to put into the optimizations. Now, to go into a little bit more detail about how we do this verification in software development, we first start by writing down a trusted specification for how we want the system to behave. We write this in what looks like a fairly standard programming language, but it's augmented with keywords like for all and exists that allow us to write the spec in a very general and declarative way. Given the specification, we then fill in the implementation, again using a high-level language called Daphne that's designed for verification. This looks like a lot like a standard imperative program, except that we add some Floyd Hoare annotations. Essentially, it means that we can say that before you call this procedure, you have to prove that you meet this requirement. And after this procedure is done, we have to prove that it's going to meet this specification. In order to help that proof go through, we sometimes add annotations to our code, such as this invariant here. Now, given these high-level specs and implementation, we then run the specification through a translator that we developed so that it can talk about the low-level hardware details where we're going to actually run. Similarly, we run the implementation through a compiler that translates both the code and the proofs into a verifiable assembly language. Now, this looks like the standard assembly language that you're accustomed to, except you'll notice that we've also translated the invariants so that instead of talking about variables, they're now talking about specific registers. And similarly, the compiler is smart enough to insert additional invariants that are going to help the eventual proof go through. Now, once this has all been done, we run the implementation code through a verifier, and that's what ultimately checks whether the implementation matches that specification that we provided. Assuming that it does, we then run the verifiable assembly language and simply strip out the proof annotations so that we have normal assembly code, and we run that through a standard assembler and linker to get an executable image. Now, there are a number of benefits to this approach. First, we're writing our specifications in a high-level declarative fashion, which makes them easy to inspect. Second, we're spending 90% of our time operating in this high-level language, which makes it easy to develop code and the proofs that go along with it. And so to give you a feel for what this looks like, I'm going to quickly do a small demo here. So here I'm trying to write a C-style procedure where I want to duplicate an array given its length. So the first thing you might do is to allocate the new array using the length that was provided. And here we see that the verifier, which is running in the background, has already identified a problem. I may have just used a negative value for doing the allocation. And so rather than adding a dynamic check, I'm going to require that anybody that calls this function prove that they haven't given us a negative value. And immediately the verifier sees that that's enough to make the allocation OK. So now I'm going to proceed and write the standard while loop for doing the copy. And as I'm writing this, I'm going to go ahead and insert an invariant. And that's going to help the prover see what values the counter might take on. So then I'm going to do the copy, update the counter. And the verifier running in the background is going to point out we have a couple of problems. So first, I may have just dereferenced a null pointer here. So that's a problem. And again, we're going to fix that by adding a requirement that anybody who calls this prove to us that we did not, in fact, pass in a null pointer. So that solves the null pointer issue, but we still have an indexing problem here. And that's because we have no reason to believe that that length argument has anything to do with the array that we were given. And so to fix that, I'm going to once again say that we need to prove that the length of the array is, in fact, equal to the argument we were given. And now the verifier says that we have no bugs remaining. But we haven't actually proven anything strong about the output. So to fix that, I'm going to write one more clause to say that we need to ensure that the two arrays are equal. This is using a specification function that I wrote earlier to say that the contents of the arrays are the same. Unfortunately, the prover can't quite see that on its own, and so I'm going to add one more hint that basically keeps track of the fact that we've correctly assigned the values as we went along. And so with that additional hint, the verifier can now sign off and say that we've met our insurer's obligation, and we've proven something non-trivial about the code. So we're able to develop in this high-level language, and yet ultimately our verification result applies to the low-level assembly code that's actually going to execute. And that means that we can put arbitrary complexity into the compiler, and we don't have to worry about introducing bugs, because they're always going to be caught by the verifier at the end. So how do we go about writing these specifications that form the core of our trusted computing base? Well, first, we write down our assumptions about how the hardware is going to behave as hardware specifications. And we do this by developing a sophisticated model of the hardware that includes not just cores, memories, and registers, but all kinds of x86 ugliness like segmentation and paging. We then, for each assembly instruction that we plan to use, we write a specification for how that instruction affects that model. So for example, the add instruction takes two registers, computes the sum, and stores that back in the original register. Now you might be saying, this is a crazy, impossible task. The Intel manuals have over 3,000 pages in them, and that's actually more pages than the original microprocessors had transistors. True fact. And even the TPM that we're using has almost 800 pages of documentation. And that seems like it's going to be a mess to translate. Fortunately, we're able to employ what we call idiomatic specification. And what that means is that we only specify the functionality that we need to use, and we make sure that our tools enforce that idiom. So for example, we specify less than 60 instructions, and then our verifier will refuse to allow the implementation to use instructions that we haven't specified. And as a concrete example, we have one XOR instruction instead of Intel, which has 28. Similarly, for the TPM, we specify what we need for secure randomness and for attestation and nothing else. And so we have under 300 lines of spec there. Now, given these hardware specifications, we write down a spec for how we want the application to behave. And we typically write this down in the form of a state machine, similar to a TLA plus specification. And so what this means is that we have a description of all the states the app can be in, the inputs that cause it to transition from one state to another, and the outputs it's allowed to emit. Now, these specs are often phrased in terms of things like signing and hashing. And so for that, we turn to the official specifications from IETF and from FIPS, and then we translate them into library specs. So for example, we have a specification for what it means to compute a hash function. Now, to ensure the fidelity of this translation, we actually employed formal spec reviews. So we had one team member develop the machine-readable spec, and another team member independently review that. We found that to be a very useful process that caught a number of bugs before we had written any code at all. So now that we have our specifications in place, we begin writing implementation code. So at the lowest level, we took the Verve verified operating system and modified it to support this late launch operation, segmentation, and IOMMU, and device IO. On top of that, we wrote a number of drivers for networking and for the TPM. We developed libraries for the network and for asymmetric and symmetric cryptography, as well as a standard library that's similar to standard libc, but without all of the bugs. And of course, on top of that, we build the app that we actually want to run. Now, there's still a problem here if we want to verify an entire system. So far, most of the examples I've shown you are examples of functional verification. And that means that you can express the output of the procedure as a function of the inputs it was given. But think about what that means if you want to apply it to an entire system at the assembly level. Well, first we need to write down all the instructions that might be visible to the outside world, since that's where information may potentially leak. So that means not just things like outb, but we also need to think about moves to, say, network buffers. And for each of those instructions, we need to write down requirements essentially as a function, ideally from all possible inputs to the system, to every word we might ever want to write out, including all those little niggling bits of initializing, say, the network card. That seems like a mess. Nobody wants to look at that. And so instead of taking this approach, we employed a different form of verification called relational verification. What that allows us to do is to annotate the instructions that read data from the outside world and say that the values they produce are public. Then for the instructions that write to the outside world, we say that they require all of their values to also be public. And so that means that by default, all we can do is take values in and send those same values out. We can't possibly leak any information in this manner. Now, of course, you might be saying, well, how do you do an interesting application? After all, if I want to release a signature, that's a function of the secret key that I'm using, and so this policy is not going to allow that. So to get around that, we allow the implementation to appeal to a trusted declassifier that's specified in terms of the application spec. And essentially what that means is that if the implementation can prove that the abstract app would have released this particular value in its current state, then the implementation can also release that value. So we wanted to do all this low-level verification and yet proceed in a very rapid fashion to iterate quickly in our code and proofs. One of the key techniques we used was to rely on automated tools, both existing tools and ones that we modified. What an automated tool means is that if you think about a proof as a tree, where the goal that you want to prove is the root and all the intermediate steps are the nodes in the tree, with an automated tool, the human fills in the first couple of steps, so the ones that require insight or some clever idea. And then the tools come along and they fill in all the low-level boring pieces that you don't really want to spend your time on. And this saves a tremendous amount of human effort. We also developed some techniques for modular verification. So one part of the system can import interfaces from other pieces of the system without having to re-verify all of that code. And that's what allows us to scale up to reasonably sized systems. And we also worked hard to preserve developer time as well. So if I verify my code and check it in, when John checks it out, his code is going to immediately verify based on the results that have been cached in the cloud. So what did we build with this methodology? Well, we built a number of applications ranging from a password protector that makes dictionary attacks impossible. We built a notary that provides a provably secure notion of logical time for the documents that it sees. We built a trusted incrementer that can be used for establishing trust among parties in a distributed system, anything from BitTorrent to replicated state machines. And as our largest application, we built a differentially private database. This allows analysts to run complex queries over the data, and yet customers know even before they submit their data that every single assembly instruction in the implementation meets the high-level formal definition of what it means to do differential privacy, which we've encoded in the application spec. So in developing all this software, we learned a number of important lessons. The first one is that when somebody from the verification community comes to you and says, hey, I've got this cool automated tool, it's important to remember that automated is not the same as automatic. What does that mean? Well, there's some things that the tool really will look at and immediately see the correct proof of, so things like non-recursive functions or addition and subtraction operations. There's other types of code that deals with existentials or arrays and sequences, where the verifier will often see it, but many times you have to give it a few hints. So you add some annotations to your code. And there's some types of code, like recursive functions or general properties of mul and div, that the verifier always seems to struggle with. Now, to be fair, properties of mul and div are technically undecidable, but it still makes for a pretty miserable programming exercise. So to deal with that, we were able to tame the recursive functions by adding support for opaque attributes to the tools, and we developed our own custom math library where we proved the properties we needed from first principles. The second big lesson we learned was that verification is a fundamentally different way to develop software. So if we go back to the software stack that I showed you before, we wrote a lot of this code over the course of weeks or even months without ever running it. And yet, almost all of it ran the first time, and it ran correctly. And I've never had that experience on any other project I've worked on, particularly when it comes to cryptographic code, where by definition, if you make one little mistake, the output's going to be totally different. And this also helps validate our specification process, since if we had an incorrect spec for something like SHA or RSA, or even segmentation, you certainly wouldn't expect it to work the first time. Now, the one exception here is the network driver, where the first implementation met its security spec, so it didn't leak any information, but we hadn't bothered with the correctness spec, and so the implementation was not correctly initializing the network card, and so we weren't sending any packets. So it was safe, but not too useful. Now, if you're interested in some of the other lessons we learned along the way, and maybe some of the war stories that we encountered as we were working on this, I'd refer you to the paper or to the poster session this evening. So when it comes to verification, you often think, well, yes, you get very strong guarantees, but isn't it going to be impossibly expensive? In our experience, it actually wasn't too bad. We found that we wrote less than 5 lines of proof hints for every line of implementation code that we developed. Now, that might sound high, but you should think about it as trading some upfront development burden for code that requires almost no testing, so code that works in general the first time you run it, and that comes with extremely strong guarantees. I'd also point out that the effort that we put into these components varied significantly. And so you can see that the bulk of the effort went into our math library, into the standard library, and so we expect that that effort will be amortized over software that's written at the higher levels. And finally, I'd note that previous efforts that worked on large-scale verification reported ratios of over 25 to 1. And so through the use of our techniques and the automated tools, we reduced that significantly. And that's reflected also in how long it took us to develop the software. So overall, it was about 3 person years compared to previous comparable-sized programs that took 22 plus. Now, to give you an idea of how much code we wrote, here you can see a breakdown between the specification in red and the implementation in blue. In a little bit more detail, the specification, we had about 3,000 lines split about evenly between software and hardware. And for the software implementation, we had almost 7,000 lines of code in this high-level language. That gives us a software implementation to specification ratio of about 4 to 1. And so the specifications really are smaller and simpler than the code that they describe. Also, I'd remind you that the code actually gets compiled to assembly instructions, over 41,000, and those are verified against the spec that we provided. And so there we have a ratio of over 23 to 1. Finally, performance was not a main goal for our project. However, I thought I'd give you a flavor of what we have, and you can see the paper for more details. We're looking at security applications, so the bottleneck is crypto. So here's symmetric crypto performance. Our initial implementation was a bit slow because we used a naive sort of basic implementation, but we've refined that over several iterations to the point where we cut overhead by 84%, and we're within 30% of completely unsafe, unverified OpenSSL. And we were able to achieve this performance by hand-tuning some of the verified assembly code that the compiler emitted. And yet, at no time did we have to worry about ruining the guarantees, because the verifier is checking us even at the low-level assembly code. And similarly for RSA, for asymmetric operations, we see a similar story where the initial version was far too slow. We improved performance by almost 4 orders of magnitude, and we still have about 22x that we want to shave off. Most of that's coming from the lack of optimizations in the compiler, and the fact that RSA is amenable to a number of number-theoretic optimizations that we simply haven't implemented yet. So briefly touch on related work. So starting in the early 70s, there was work on high-assurance kernels, where you often had a formal specification, but the tools were just not adequate to prove that the code actually met that specification. Lately, we've seen a lot of projects that have been bridging that gap, with SEL4 being a sort of a shining example. These have typically focused on a single layer, say the operating system, and many of them have verified existing or new C code, which means they often get good performance right out of the gate. SEL4 actually took that another step further and verified all the way down to the machine code that runs on the system. However, many of these systems did not use the kind of automated tools that we were employing, and so they traded a lot of human effort for the verification. So just to wrap up, with Ironclad, we're able to guarantee strong end-to-end security properties to remote users, and those guarantees hold for every single assembly instruction that executes. We're able to do this through new and modified tools, as well as a methodology focused on rapid development of verified software. And I hope that the message you come away from this talk with is that verification of system software is becoming quite feasible. And finally, I'd like to note that our code, specifications, and tools will be made available online. And with that, thank you for your attention.
Can you just say just a few words on concurrency?
So, great question. So far, we're operating on a single processor. Some of our colleagues are working on a version that would handle multi-core, but the state of the art in verification for concurrent programs is way behind where it is on single processor or on single-threaded programs. And so we haven't tackled that yet, but I think it's a great question.
So, Hao Huimai from Hortonworks, and very nice work. I'm wondering. I just briefly skimmed through the paper, and seems the it's pretty focused on pretty much on primitive array operation. Do you have any experience on slightly more complicated data structures like double linked lists or trees in other components that you have been verified?
So you're asking what kind of data structures we used?
For example, linked lists or trees that might be pretty useful in the networking stacks.
I'd have to think. I think most of the data structures we were using were fairly simple. I think a lot of our effort went into proving things like RSA operations were done correctly. So we spent more time on sort of number theoretic proofs than we did on data structure proofs. But data structure proofs are a fairly standard sort of classic example of how you use verification. So I wouldn't expect a lot of challenges there.
Hi, Henry from Stanford University. Can your verification be extended to handle timing-based attacks such that you can assure constant time for particular cryptographic operations?
So great question, and that's certainly a concern when you're implementing cryptographic algorithms. I think that would be possible, and I think there's some groups that have been working on timing analysis. I know SEL4 has some guarantees about worst-case execution time, but that's not something we've looked at yet.
Thank you.
Gernot Heiser, NICTA and UNSW. As you point out, your correctness pretty much is tied to the corrections of the spec, and your answer for getting that right is essentially a traditional top-down software engineering approach, which of course we know doesn't really work for real software. So do you have any hope in getting this kind of assurance for something that has a more modern and useful software engineering approach?
So your question is, how can we gain assurance that these specifications were written correctly?
Yes, without relying on this strict top-down approach.
Yeah, so I think there's always going to be a human aspect to the process, right? Ultimately, we're trying to build software that matches what the idea that you have in your mind. And so there's always going to be a human-level process that involves things like spec reviews. And in our experience, we found those were quite useful. I think the other thing you can do is take the specification and then say, there's a particular property I care about, whether it's information flow or access control, and prove that against the specification. And if your implementation meets the specification, then you know that the implementation also meets this desired property. And I know the SEL4 team has some experience with proofs of that nature.
Hi, I'm Anvesha from NC State. My question is not in the context of security, but I'm a little curious to know that can your idea be extended or leveraged to add some constraints in the sense that you have requires and ensures, right, which ultimately helps you for verification. So can I add some constraints when you do code verification to ensure that certain requirements of the code is met or not, say in terms of the code flow or the way I navigate through the application software source code, because I work with that. So at the end, I need to do some constraint solving and I need to come up with some required inputs. So you do code system end-to-end system verification. Mm-hmm. So can I use it? Can I use your tool or can I use your idea to leverage this so that I know whether the input is met or not? You know, you understand?
So are you asking, can we verify smaller chunks of software than an entire system?
Yes. Our application source code in terms of the additional constraints I give.
Certainly. So I mean, we wanted to be ambitious, so we targeted an entire system, but you can certainly employ these tools for smaller pieces of code or just focus on the application level itself. You can also use the underlying primitives, so things like the SMT solver that we employ, to do things like constraint solving, and there's other projects that have looked at that.
And if there are external library interactions, will that handle it?
So if you want to work with unverified external libraries,
right,
then you basically need to either write down your assumptions about how that code is going to behave, or write down, not have any assumptions, and then your code needs to be proven that it's going to make the adequate checks.
Okay, thank you.
Hello, Kent Williams-King from the University of British Columbia. I'm not terribly familiar with this area, but I do have one question for you, because this jumped out at me as you were running through your example. What happens if you accidentally annotate something with an incorrect annotation? So if you say, for example, if variable I is within some range and you accidentally annotate it to be within a smaller range.
Sure. So all the annotations that we're adding are, you can consider essentially hints. So the prover will first attempt to prove that that hint that you gave it is correct before it uses it. So if I write down an incorrect invariant, say that the counter is always less than zero, then the verifier is going to check that and see that it's not valid. It's going to give me a complaint about that. And then it's going to essentially discard it and not use it in the rest of the proof.
Okay, thank you.